Hey everybody, welcome to Sound Bombing. I created this show for people who want to experience a radical, life-changing journey through the sounds of my diverse guests. I hope that each sound you hear on this show will strengthen your faith, encourage your dreams, and challenge you to awaken the greatness within you.
Drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're gonna drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're gonna drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We come to drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new values, and a new experience.
Lamar Darnell Shields.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good day, Sound Bombing community. This is your man, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields, for another exciting day with you in the bomb shelter. But you know we do all the time, all of my bombers out there. Before we get this party started, we always have to do what? I heard you say it. Yes, the breath of life. So we're going to do our three breaths. So we do our inhale, and then we exhale. We're going to do that one more time. We inhale, and then we exhale. Last time, inhales go deeper, and then we exhale. Sound bombers, what is that called? You know what it's called. It's called the breath of life. And with that breath, that says that we are here. And I am glad that you are here with me, because you could have been anywhere. There are so many podcasts out there, but you decided to hang out with your boy in the Sound Bombing Studios in what we call the bomb shelter. And I'm not here by myself, because you know I got somebody with me. But before I introduce my amazing guest, I want to talk about the term social capital. See, the term social capital has been around for almost a century. However, it has only recently become popular. Shared values and understandings in society provide both groups, individuals with strong social contacts and the trust they need to effectively work together. It is said to be the key to entrepreneurial success. Well, the ability to move up, down, and sideways through different varieties of social networks is an important life skill, especially when it comes to maintaining relationships and even a job. And although it is important to create a diverse network and develop relationships across all these categories, social bonds are particularly advantageous, as they are most likely to have positive emotional, social, and economic impact on any individual. You see, a recent survey found that 85% of jobs are filled as a result of networking, which demonstrates the concept that people don't secure as many jobs through traditional methods as they do through personal contacts. To successfully build a strong network and social capital, you need to be especially proactive and strategic when networking in order to create a solid relationship which supports your career aspirations. In Tanner Colby's book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America, there is a line that reads, "You are the sum total of the people you meet and interact with in the world. Whether it's your family, peers, coworkers, the opportunities you have had, and the things you've learned all come through the doors that other people open for you." So our next guest knows a lot about this. And our next guest will tell us how getting involved in networking early on and fully immersing yourself within it is thought to be an invaluable asset when learning how to effectively build a social capital complex. We will learn why we need to get our name out there and to go to as many networking events as possible, but make sure you're wearing a mask, because COVID is out there networking too, to build relationships and pursue many great opportunities, as well as how to improve your social capital. Well, who am I talking about? I'm talking about Francois Booker Drew. Let me just say that again. Dr. Francois Booker Drew is a network weaver who believes relationships are the key to our personal, professional, and organizational growth. She has been quoted in Forbes, Ozzy, Bustle, Huffington Post, and she's about to be quoted right here on Soundbombing and other media outlets due to an extensive background in leadership, nonprofit management, partnership development, training, and education. She is currently Vice President of Community Affairs for the State Fair of Texas, responsible for grant-making, educational program, and community initiative. She is also the founder for Heritage, get it, H-E-R-A-T-I-G-E. I'm just playing around, it's Heritage, Giving Circle, and the owner of Solstice Consultancy. Francois graduated with a PhD from Antioch University in Leadership and Change with the focus on social capital, diverse women, and relational leaderships. I would like to welcome into the Soundbombing Studios, my friend from the great state of Texas, Francois Booker Drew. Yay, what's up, Francois?
Thank you for having me. Oh, wow, that was an amazing intro. I want to meet her.
you haven't been being introduced, like you're waiting, you're on the stage and you're about to be introduced and you're sitting there and the person who is introducing you is reading about this great person. And then you look around the room like, man, who in a ham sandwich are they talking about? Because I want to meet that person. Well, I am honored that you decided to join me today. And so how are you doing? I'm always checking in with my community just to see how they're doing during this pandemic.
You know, it changes because when it first started, I thought it was going to be a vacation. And I was just going to be at home doing stuff, and it got busy. Zoom became a way of life. And then I realized how much I miss people.
Because yes.
Even though you have the Zoom and I'm connected, I don't think we realize the power of presence and being close to each other and having proximity. And I miss that. Although I'm well, and you know, with everything that's going on in the world, obviously we're all going through these various emotions. But I realize more and more how presence makes a difference. So I'm good. I just miss people a lot.
Well, I miss people, but I don't miss that COVID jumping in all over my body.
I'm with you. I'm cooties and I don't work. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you talk about social capital. We're going to talk about that. But one of the things that I have not been appreciating from the world is they talk about social distancing. And I'm always correcting people. I tell people we need to physically distance ourselves from one another.
Agreed.
Because we are social animals. And the moment that we stop being social, then we become other than what the Creator created us to be. And so, you know, you want to physically distance yourself from one another, not socially distance. And I tell people, go, you know, you want to be social. You want to check on your elders. You want to check on your family members. But you don't want to bring COVID to their house. You want to leave a gift on the porch. You want to give them a call and just check in with them. And so I appreciate, you know, you talking, because we're going to talk about the word social. We're going to talk about capital. And we're going to talk about all the great things that you're doing. So I'm excited about this. So tell us about the idea of building relationships through social capital. And then how are you able to build social capital during this COVID pandemic? If so, how?
Yes, I'll start with that question. Definitely you can build social capital during this time. I think people are taking for granted that you have a captive audience right now. People are at home. So how do you begin to use your LinkedIn profile and those folks that are first, second, you know, degree connections, reach out. If there are people that you'd like to meet, this is an opportunity to say, I'd like to have coffee. You know, and there's some amazing apps that are out there that you can begin to start building these relationships with people. So I think folks are taking it for granted that because you're at home, it means that you need to be in isolation. You do from the disease, but it doesn't mean, to your point, from people. So leveraging, as you said, you know, calling people, but leveraging your existing relationships and going deeper is going to be very important. And you can do that in the midst of a pandemic and do it well.
So you're talking about using some tools to remain social. So you talked about LinkedIn and some other platforms that are out there. After this pandemic is over, because eventually it's going to be over, how do you think we're going to then socialize with one another? Because let me just give you an example. I was on a running trail. I ran into my buddy Atman. He is a meditation teacher, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. And I saw him on a running trail with with his dog, and it could have been his girlfriend. And so I was about to walk up to him, and Francois, it looked strange. It looked like we got busted doing something, because I wanted to hug him, I wanted to embrace him. And it was like we were doing like a dance like this. And I just said, hey, what's up, bro? Good to see you. It felt really strange. And so how do you think we're going to become, how do you think we're going to be after this pandemic is over? Are we going to be less social? Are we going to be more social?
I think people are going to still be social. You see it even in the midst of the pandemic with all the warnings. You see folks at the beach sitting out talking to each other. So we were made to be in community, and I think people are desiring that now. But I do think it's going to look different. I don't think the handshake is going to be around. I think at some point it will probably come back. But I think for the next couple of years, people are going to be very hesitant of shaking hands. It's funny you said that, because I was meeting with someone, and I wanted to go up and hug them. And I did this elbow thing. And I said, you know, let's just do elbows. And so it's learning these new ways of connecting, and then doing the Wakanda thing. It's like, how you doing? You know, and finding these different ways to connect. But I do think that people are still going to find ways to have community. It's going to look different. I don't think we're going to see groups of hundreds of people hanging out together. I think the idea of luncheons with, you know, hundreds of people in galas are going to look very different. But smaller gatherings, I think you're going to see more intentionality around people being in these smaller groups where they are able to distance. But the large group events, it's going to be interesting to see how that looks over the next couple of years. Once the vaccine and treatments come, I think people will go back to that. But for the next couple of years, all of us are going to be a bit apprehensive about getting sick.
Yeah. So I know, with that being said, I know you focus a lot on relationships. You focus a lot on social capital. I want to go way back, before the writing, before the lectures, before the PhD. Tell our listeners about your journey and your body of work focused on relationships. How have relationships impacted you and your life?
You know, I didn't know the term. And I realized that there's been this common thread through my life of relationships that shape me. You know, I watched my parents, who my dad opened a restaurant when I was in middle school. And I watched my dad interact with all these different people, him and my mom, where Doug Williams, I remember, came to our restaurant. And so I was able to see.
Hold up, we need to stop right there. We got to send a shout out to Doug. You know, I went to the great Grambling State University. I know you got some Louisiana roots. I got to shout out my homeboy, Grambling State, Doug Williams, MVP, Washington Redskins, first African-American MVP. All right, so I just need to pause there for a second. So he walks into your restaurant.
and I grew up in Shreveport, so to give
you from Port City, what?
Yes, I grew up in Shreveport, and so,
and you made it out? No, I'm just playing.
Yes, and that's another conversation. Yes, and you know, I saw people like that were coming in, and all these different kinds of people. And at the time, I didn't realize what was happening, but it was a form of currency that was going on. That these people opened up doors and introduced folks to my dad, who brought people into the restaurant, and it grew the notoriety of the place. Plus, the food was amazing. And when I left and went to college, I did not understand the power of connecting until things started to happen. So I started volunteering in college, and I got introduced to all these very different people, political leaders and, you know, folks that were movers and shakers in our community. And my first job was really the result of social capital. I was volunteering on the weekends teaching young people about diversity, and I always joke and go, in retrospect, I probably wasn't the one to teach that because I was so young and learning. But I'm teaching them, and I had no idea that these people were watching me. So I'm on my way to another job, about to graduate from college, and I get in a car accident.
Wow.
Get hit into oncoming traffic, knocked completely around, leave the hospital, and I get a phone call. There was no cell phones at that time, all that stuff. I get a phone call, and it was divine. And I got offered a job that was paying twice as much as the job I was on my way to, but it was from the volunteering. The people who were there were watching me. And when the opportunity came open, I was offered an assistant director position at 21 years old, working for Texas A&M. And to be in a position with a statewide organization, because I was working in their satellite offices to help young people go to college, I did not recognize the power of those relationships. One, just showing up. And when you show up, showing up in a spirit of excellence. So at that time, I did the best that I could. I was on time. You know, I was cordial to people. I made sure that, you know, I was engaging. And I think all of that opened up the door to that possibility, which transformed my life. The lady who was my boss is my mentor all these years later. She's phenomenal in our area. But just recognizing that it's not just the goal to get the relationship. I think we always just so bent on, I got to know this person. I think there has to be this deliberate action around maintaining the relationship as well. And for me, I've had this gift of all those people from college. So many of them are still in my life today. And so having relationships is not just about getting a business card. It really is, how do you develop, you know, these relationships that are not just transactional, but they really can become transformational. And not all relationships are going to look like that. But I think we have to really focus on how do you have both.
Well, I know you've been writing and lecturing about this for some time. Share with the audience the premise of your first book, The Rules of Engagement and Making Connections Last. Why did you write this book, and what's the premise of this book?
You know, I wrote the book because I was doing research with a group of women, and I was learning all these lessons from these women sharing their journey. And one of the things that hit me is, as much as it's important to build relationships, the first relationship is with you. And so if you don't really understand your own story and the power of your own narrative, then the challenge becomes, how do you connect to other people when you don't really understand who you are and what purpose looks like? And so I started listening to these women's stories and began to start taking these lessons from it. And that's how the book started, was combining their lessons and my own and helping women think about, how do you understand your narrative? And then using your narrative as an opportunity to connect to other people. So if your narrative is one that everybody is awful, I can't trust men, they're all those things, what you don't realize is you bring more of that into your space. And so I wanted women to recognize, what are you bringing into your space based on the stories that you're telling? And when your narrative becomes one of, you know, great people, I love life, you begin to start getting more of that. Now, I'm not saying that you lie to yourself and become delusional. But what I am saying is that the lens that we use, we will begin to focus more on what we pay attention to all the time. And if it's always negative, you're going to keep bringing that up into your space. And I wanted folks to recognize that once you change that, the possibilities are unlimited for you. I know, you know, very young in my career, and it was really more elementary school and middle school, that I had this issue about I couldn't trust women. Well, I had to really begin to start unraveling that, even though I had some bad experiences, and not to let people off the hook for their bad behavior, but I had to really begin to investigate, what role did I play in it? And when I changed my thinking and began to trust myself even more, the people that came into my life, when I began to value myself even more, the folks who stepped in, I have an amazing support system of people who love me, but I had to love myself. And then once that happened, I noticed things began to change. So I always tell folks that social capital is important, but the first rule of that is, you're going to be involved in every relationship. You're the common denominator. So you got to work on you, as well as pursue these wonderful mentors and sponsors and opportunities that can change your life.
What is the genesis of your distrust with women? Where did that come from? And at such a very young age?
I was bullied profusely in elementary school.
Those girls are mean.
They were.
They could be mean and vicious, right?
Mean.
And then when they like you, they're mean. Like, what is that about? Like, you and I on the playground, and your friend said, Francois likes you, but she punched me in the jaw. What is that about?
Well, and you got it from guys, too. So the little boys would be mean and pick on you because they liked you, which made no sense. And then you had the girls doing the same thing. So it's like, everybody's crazy. I'm staying away from all of y'all. And I think a lot of it for me, too, was for a number of years, I was an only child. And when you're an only child, you're around adults. So when you see stuff that kids are doing, you're like, that's so dumb, because you're around adults and you're using that as your point of reference as to how they handle things. So a lot of that for me started with those very early, you know, situations I dealt with girls being mean. But what I had to learn from that is, move on, find another group of folks who are going to treat you well. You don't stay and allow people to do that. And my mother was so instrumental, because it happened to her. And she told me one day, she's like, listen, you better go find you another group of friends, because I'm tired of this happening. So you stop it, or I'm going to stop it. And I was like, well, what we're not going to do is let her stop it. I'm going to go on and do something different. And it also taught me in that moment, responsibility for my own life and my actions, that as much as they were wrong, even in that moment, I could do something. I wasn't completely powerless.
I'd love to hear that. Francois, how important are questions to you in your work?
How important are questions? They're very important. I think you have to be able to ask questions of yourself. I think you have to be able to do that of other people, but it's what questions you ask. You know, sometimes I think we ask the wrong question. And there's this technique that I've been doing that is so powerful to me. It's so what? So for every answer that I give to something, it's so what? So I go, oh, they hurt my feelings. So what? And by the time you get to the fourth so what, you really have your answer. And it's this questioning technique that you go through to begin to say, okay, so what I said was really bothering me may not really be what it is. This third or fourth so what is the answer to what's going on. And so now I know that it's not that I'm so upset that they're bothering me. I'm upset by how it makes me feel. And maybe I feel powerless, or I feel like, you know, I was in third grade again. Whatever it is, I think we don't ask the right questions.
Yeah, questions have a lot of value sort of where I am right now. Over the last couple of days, you know, most of the people that I brought into the bomb shelter with me, we've unpacked questions. And we've talked about our own questions and questions of the people that we're working with. During this time of COVID, and I know that you are doing a lot of work in the Dallas area, working with folks who are dealing with the COVID pandemic, what are some questions that we should be asking ourselves on a daily basis as it relates to where we are? And then what could we do to be in community with others in this age of social distancing?
I think the questions that we need to ask ourselves is, it's a couple of things. I think, what is purpose? Because I don't think it's an accident that we're in a time like we're in right now. I think the fact that the world has had to pause, when in any of our lifetimes have you had to have the world go on complete pause? So what does it mean that when we get out of this, what does it mean for your life? Because your life is not going to look different. And I honestly believe that those individuals who take this time to really begin to start digging deeper into what it means for them and their existence are going to come out on the other side a whole lot better and faster. And so this is a gift, despite how frightening it may be and all these unknown variables. I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, what am I going to do and contribute to making my life better and the life of those around me better? And this is a prime opportunity to start doing that. I've been talking to folks about, what are your dreams? Because you have an opportunity now, and you don't have the distraction of driving to work and the commute and all those things. What are the things that are calling you? And where is that book that's been laying in the garage that you said you're going to do, or the painting? Where is it? Bring those things out and call them out into fruition and make it happen. So I think those are the kinds of questions that we had to ask ourselves. But as it relates to community, I think it's, what is my place and where do I fit and what are things that I can do? Even in a COVID situation where there is physical distancing, you still can volunteer and help people. I find myself inundated with opportunities to make a difference. So whether that is helping, you know, nonprofits, I spend a lot of time connecting nonprofits to resources. Folks are still doing work. Folks are still on the front line serving. How do you support them? It doesn't mean that you got to go out there and get sick, but it does mean there are things that you can do with your gifts and talents and how you leverage that to help nonprofits that are doing the work. So could you do research for someone? Could you connect them to a possible donor? Could you donate money? I think there's some real opportunities in this season where we can ask ourselves those hard questions about, who am I and what can I do to make a difference?
Well, I know philanthropy is a part of your work at the State Fair of Texas. Yeah. How are you trying to change the narrative in the space and through your work of Heritage Giving Fund? And can you tell our listeners more about that type of work?
So I started at State Fair in 2016, and there was no community affairs department. We were being slammed by the media probably every other day because, yeah, this entity that is a multi-million dollar entity that sits in the heart of the Black community in Dallas brings in 24 days, 2.3 million visitors. It's huge. And so it's an economic engine. And so people were feeling like they weren't included. And I had worked in that community for years in different ways. My church is there. And I remember even in my interview saying some things about, hey, I got some questions, and was so blessed that they said, even in spite of my questions, said, come on, you can help. And because I did, I asked some things. I was like, really? Well, what about this? And I've been fortunate to be able to come in and develop a department that really focuses on that neighborhood and looks at how do we use our social capital, our financial capital, how do we use our human capital, our experiences and education, and to infuse that into this community that has a lot of need. And I focus more on how do we impact at the organizational and systemic level, because we're not doing necessarily case management and doing that direct service. But to me, I think there are ways that you can still make impact on individuals in those spaces. And so for me to be able to look at how do we use our funding to impact, you know, all of these issues like economic development, impact capacity building for nonprofits, and, you know, even use it from a racial equity lens. And trying to make sure that with our fundees, we did about 67 organizations last year that got almost $500,000. Well, you know, over 90% of those were led by people of color. It's changing the narrative of funding, because typically, and research has shown it, you don't see organizations that are led by people of color getting funding. It's usually a very small percentage. And then research has come out to say that less than 4% of donations are given to organizations led by African-American women. And that's where Heritage came in. Was Heritage was another opportunity to change the narrative. It was a friend of mine, Akila Wallace, who came and said, hey, I want you to help me create this giving circle. And so me and Dr. Halima Leek Francis are co-founders with her and started this Black Women's Giving Circle, with the whole point of taking Black women's money and placing it in organizations led by Black women. And so I really am fortunate, because in both of those spaces, I'm able to assist in what funding looks like. I know when I go to meetings, I typically am one of the few, if not the only African-American who's in the room that's making decisions on funding and talking to other funders about that. And I love that we're not only able to give money, but during COVID, I was able to work with this funders collaborative and help make sure that those organizations and our communities got those funds, where it wasn't always the big name ones. I won't name them, you know who they are, but it wasn't always the usual suspects, as I call them. It was the smaller grassroots nonprofits that are on the ground that I was able to go, look at this one. I funded them. I want you to do something about it. And so it's been a gift to be at the table and watch the dynamics in the room begin to change. It is going to take time, but philanthropy is one of those spaces that historically has not really been accessible to not only, you know, Black folks, but people of color, period.
Yeah, I think that many of us struggle with coming up with strategies and ways to sustain our organization,
yes,
to raise money, and to keep functioning. And what I notice about many of the organizations of color, because I've been funded through the Open Society Institute and some other foundations, a lot of the times, Francois, I think people, like say the Ma and Pa organization, they feel intimidated with completing a form, talking about tax purposes, how many people are they serving, data, support, research. And I remember calling the philanthropy community to the table a couple of years ago, you know, me and a couple of other people who are able to put a foot in the boardroom and a foot in the body or the hood. And everybody can't do that. Everybody can't come to the boardroom and go to the neighborhood.
That's social capital, though.
Yeah, and so it was important for us to call these funders, because the funders wanted to give, but they were trying to figure out why were the people of color not coming to the table. And again, you know, I'm looking at some of the organizations that are being funded. I said, if I see one more garden program, if I see one more arts program, I'm going to lose my mind. And there's so many, you know what I'm talking about. There's so many other organizations that I'm like, if we paint one more mural, I'm going to destroy something in this place. And so when I look at some of the other people that are doing the great work, you know, I want to just applaud you for that, because I love giving circles. I love women. I'm seeing a lot of women giving circles.
Yes.
But even though we have these giving circles, our finances cannot compare to other communities.
No.
How can we shift that? And what are you doing to try to shift that narrative?
Well,
because there's still this imbalance that exists.
It is. Well, and it's the imbalance of power, because, you know, there's a level of wealth that we just haven't had because we haven't been in the game. As you know, if you've been able to have a footing for hundreds of years, and then I just show up at the table, I still got a ways, even though I'm at the table, I still got a ways to go, because you got hundreds of years of information and relationships that I just don't have access to. You know, it was one of my friends, white female, who said to me, you know, Francois, you talk about being at these tables. What table do I need to introduce you to? And I told her, I said, there are tables I'm unaware of. I can't even begin to tell you, because even in my role, there are entities that I'm coming in contact with and I'm going, I never even knew this existed. Yeah. So it's hard to even play catch up when you don't have the whole, you know, realm of information available to you. I think for, you know, a lot of small organizations, we're going to have to start coming together and really, you know, it's a couple of things. It's demanding, because some of that money, and I won't even say some, foundation money has been on the backs of people who built those entities, that they turned that money over from their corporations or their families into foundations. And so when we look at a lot of the entities that are huge and have foundations, somebody, black or brown, was working unpaid or getting low wages and not what they deserve, and helped make somebody else rich. So in my mind, because of that, I didn't have generational wealth. You were able to get that because of it. So we need to talk about that, because I didn't get to benefit in the way that you did. So I think it's having those hard questions about how that wealth came in. How do we begin to start not only addressing that wealth and how it needs to be redistributed, but at the same time, I think we need to start having conversation about what does it look like in our community to pool our resources and really begin to start thinking about our own foundations beyond just the giving circles. But to me, it's more than the money. Because I've seen groups have a lot of money come in, and money can make a difference. But if you don't have the infrastructure and you don't necessarily have the plan of how you're going to sustain yourself, I can infuse millions of dollars and in, you know, a year you're out of business. So I think it's helping our folks think about how do you become socially a social entrepreneur. And what does it really begin to look like where you're doing, you know, these ideas of like B Corps, where you have these companies that are making money, but there's the social good aspect of it. And so it's-
I'm a part of several, shout out to Taharka Brothers Ice Cream in Baltimore, an organization run by African-American kids in Baltimore City. They're using ice cream as a form of social justice.
Yes.
And they are a B Corp organization.
They
have ownership of it. And they also are giving back to the community as well.
And so it has to be this combination of not just give me money, give me money. Yeah, that's a piece of it that we need to get those things. But on the flip side, I think there has to be this idea of how do you create entrepreneurial opportunities? And even with our athletes, helping them with, it's more than giving out turkeys. That's good. But folks are hungry besides Thanksgiving and Christmas.
I just had a conversation with Todd Gurley's father. He's a famous football player. People, you can Google him. And I just asked his dad on Saturday, because his dad gets his haircut in the shop with me. And I said, tell me some of the things that Todd is doing off the field. And he ran down a list of those things. And I shared with him the work that I was doing with Ray Lewis. I'd done some work with some other players in the NFL, some of the entertainers. But I'm always concerned about folks who are not giving back, because I think the people that have the most are the people that give the most. And what he said was, I taught Todd at a very young age, so he didn't have to think about giving. Todd knew that he needed to give back. And I think it's all of our responsibility. It's the rent that we pay to be on this planet. It's giving back. And it's about serving. And what you're talking about, the giving circles, philanthropy, B Corp organizations, I think that those things are very, very important. And the work that you're doing on the streets out there around COVID, and people are observing that. People observe what we're doing. And you said it's not about the money, it's about the impact that you're actually making. You're one of those individuals that my buddy Jeff Robinson wrote about. It's called Black faces in white spaces? And how do you feel being one of those Black spaces in white space, Black faces in white spaces? And what are you learning about those rooms that you get invited in that your peers may not get invited in to?
You know, for me, because social capital is such a thread, I see it as opportunity. And it allows me to be a bridge. You know, there are two types of social capital. There's the bonding that we connect to folks that are just like us, and all of us do that. I am learning more and more as I get older the value of bridging social capital or linking, which is connecting to people that are different than you, who don't believe the same things that you do, and recognizing that there's information that folks have access to that, because they are different than I am, that I just don't know because I didn't grow up in Iowa. I won't know that, but being in those spaces allows me access to information that I can serve as a bridge to these various communities, but also a translator, because I'm able to say in those rooms, that's not going to work. Let me tell you why that won't work in the hood, because this is, and they're like, oh, wow, I didn't know that, you know, or being able to say in my own community, y'all, that's not going to work, because let me tell you how they're seeing this. So it gives me the opportunity to do both. And I think because I'm so comfortable with who I am, I don't have a problem with floating back in and out of those different spaces, because I'm always going to be authentic. I think where people get confused is when they're trying to be something that they're not, and they get lost in the translation. Whereas for me, it's the whole focus is, how do I go in these spaces and use these opportunities to really impact people who will never possibly have access to them? So it's not about me going in and promoting me and what I'm doing as much as it is an opportunity to go in and get information that can really help the people that I know may not ever get a chance to know folks. And I'm able to connect people. I spend so much of my time being a connector between various communities and saying, you need to know this person. Y'all may look different. You may be totally different in your political ideology, but y'all got some things in common. Talk. And it is amazing to see that when people are placed in safe spaces, that regardless of what they look like, they can find commonalities and go, yeah, I may not agree with that, but I understand loss. And I lost my mother. Or I lost, you know what I mean? And so for me, I go in those spaces knowing that I'm a Black woman, but also knowing that there are all these different intersections that define my journey. And I am so much more than what I look like. And I can use all of those different pieces of who I am to be able to connect to people and still recognize who I am and the power of that.
Do you ever feel alone in those spaces? And do you ever feel like you are fighting an uphill battle at all?
There are times I have felt like that. Recently, I'm hopeful, though, because I am in some spaces with folks who don't understand but want to get it. And sometimes it is frustrating. But I have to keep in mind that this struggle that we're in did not happen overnight. I was doing a presentation on Friday for Juneteenth for SurveyMonkey staff. And I was explaining to them why we are in the situation where you see the protest, that it wasn't overnight, y'all, that folks just got mad because of, you know, people getting killed. Y'all, this has been historical. And I started at 16, 19 and just went through giving some highlights of, these are the situations that have happened. I think that is the same case when we look at, you know, me walking into those spaces and looking at institutions that have been around for hundreds of years. This didn't happen overnight. And I have to be mindful that even though it is an uphill battle and it gets frustrating, that change takes time. I have to be committed to that. And I think a lot of folks get in and want it to be a microwave where, bam, you know, I put it in, I say what I want, and it's going to happen overnight. There are some things that can. You're seeing some things that people are going, policing, we need to pay attention to that. But it's been this process. And I think it's, for me, knowing that even with the uphill battles, knowing that I may be the only one in that space, that I am committed to being there, because I know that folks behind me are dependent on me to do that. And that there are other folks who died for me to have those opportunities that they never would have had access to. So to whom much is given, much is required.
So what are some of the tools and rituals that you might use to then that you can share with our listeners that keep you going, that keep you motivated, that keep you on the right track when there are some days that you just don't want to show up to do this work?
My faith. it's bigger than me. This has nothing to do with who I am. And when you see it that way, that you are playing a role in history, I mean, let's be honest, this is a historic moment. How many folks can say you lived during a pandemic and made it? You are a part of history. And so for me, it's not looking at it as, oh my God, it's so awful. It is, I'm being held responsible. And so what makes me wake up in the morning is I get to play a part, even if it's this big, I still get to play a part in changing people's lives. That's what gets me excited and gets me up. It's not about me at all. So my faith is a tool that's huge for me. So I use that to guide me. I also use my family and friends, because I have folks that were not blessed to be able to go and get a PhD. And I recognize that I am standing on the shoulders of other people who are looking up to me and are proud of me. And so for me, it's this, I have to give something back to the very people who poured something into me. That's what gets me excited. So it's paying attention to my support systems and allowing that to feed me and fuel me, because that's the only way you can do this work. And then I am learning to pour back even into myself, because it's easy in these spaces to pour out so much of who you are that you get so angry and bitter and frustrated because, one, your focus was on getting something back. My focus is so much bigger than that. It's yes, I need to be replenished and have things come back. But again, it's taking the focus off of this is about me and really focusing on something that is bigger, which because of my faith, it's heavenly. You know, one of the most profound things I told a group this yesterday that I've ever done in my life was write my obituary. It was one of the most impactful things. It was so morbid. But in writing my obituary gave me this to live, because I wrote about how I wanted to be remembered. And what I do in my life is legacy. All of this is about creating legacy for my kid, for other people's children. And in writing that, it made me go, oh, wow. So if I want to be remembered that way, I got to get to living. And that's the that keeps me going, is creating this legacy that when my great, great, great grandchildren, who I may not ever know, can look back on the internet and see, man, that lady did this so that my life could be better. She wrote these things so that other people's lives could look better. And they're in a better place because of what I did, that just that little bit made a difference. That's why I do it.
So how can our listeners get in contact with you, and how can they pick up a copy of several of the books that you've actually written?
So the first two, you can go on Amazon. You can go to Austin Brothers Publishing and pick those up. The last book, which was written for my daughter, Fly Away, another book of lessons. You can tell there's a thread. I like to share my experience and help folks. And that book is at drfrostwad.com. But you can reach out to me on the website at drfrostwad.com. I tend to answer because this social capital thing, I live it. I don't just talk it. And so I love talking to people and connecting and looking at, you know, how do we use resources to change not only ourselves, but our communities. So that's where you can find me.
Well, before you get out of here, Dr. Francois Booker Drew, we have to do my favorite part of the show. It is called the Super Bomb Question. It's an opportunity for me to ask you some cool questions that my listeners sent in, and they want to know a little bit more about the people that I bring on the show. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So what's your favorite word?
Melancholy.
What's your favorite quote?
Marianne Williamson, the quote about... Who are you not to be gorgeous and brilliant? It's such a long quote, but that is my favorite quote on the planet.
What's your superpower?
Connecting.
What brings you to tears of joy?
It's so many things. Watching Arrested Development cracks me up and brings me tears of joy.
What brings you to tears of sorrow?
Watching folks not be able to breathe.
What's your spirit animal?
A lion.
What do you wish you had more time to do?
I wish I had more time to write.
What deceased person would you most like to want to meet and get advice from?
I would love to meet Martin Luther King. Would love to.
If you were in the Miss America talent competition, Francois, what would your talent be?
This is hysterical. Opera.
opera.
I would actually probably do. This is what's crazy. I really wanted to be an opera singer when I was younger, and changed my mind and said I'm gonna be a history major.
So you know now I was about to put you on the spot. I was about to ask you.
No, I am not. That paid for the shower.
Well, Dr. Francois Booker Drew, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining me today in the Bomb Shelter.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Oh, wow. It was a pleasure talking to you. I want to also like to thank my engineer, Alec Blanc, my producer, Nicole Klimpaka, Supremacy, for our theme music, and all of you for listening. Make sure you subscribe, leave a comment, stop being stingy, share with me on all social media platforms. I am there. If you want to know more about me, go to drlds.com, drlds.com. And all, as always, believe that something wonderful is about to happen, and that some people miss the message because they're too busy looking for the mess. Thanks for tuning in, and do something for someone other than yourself today. You've been listening to Sound Bombing. Peace.